All right, good afternoon. Welcome to this session. Boilerplate stuff. My name is Gert Drapers, originally. We're going to talk about Hadoop today and how that fits into the ecosystem and what we have done since we announced that 2 years ago. How many of you played with Hadoop? How many of you actually use HD Insight? Okay, good. So we can start from the beginning. All right, so here we go. So we all are hopefully aware that it's like we're producing data at a rate which is immensely growing right now by all our devices. Not only just phones, sensors, all sorts of devices, but it's like we have a huge set of data that we have out there. And we're accumulating more and more and more. And the current strategy is, how many of you do data warehousing projects? Quite a few. So the current strategy in an ETL form is like you have some data that comes into your warehouse. And the first thing you're going to look at is like, well, I have this amount of data coming in. I only need this. So what am I going to do? I'm going to reduce it down. I'm going to throw away all the rest. And then it's like you come back later and it's like, oops. That was wrong. I didn't know I had to answer that question. So I have to go back, bring the data into the warehouse, and go again. And so that's a common problem that we've seen. It's actually one of the things that you can address with things like Hadoop, but we'll get back to that later. The other aspect is that the data, where it used to be very structured before, it's like we're not only increasing volumes, we're also increasing the speed in which data arrives and the shapes in which it arrives. So now it's like we have this desire in terms of like, well, if you're a company and you have, say, it's like you want to project out what your customers are going to do, well, one free medium for you to tap into would be something like Twitter or the weather, or other things that might influence the behavior of your customers. And those data feeds might not be in the same shapes or in the structured forms that you're used to dealing with, but yet you still want to combine those things. And so the Hadoop ecosystem tries to cater to all these kind of scenarios. Dealing with massive amounts of data, combining those data in different forms, moving them from one structure into the other, doing that using commodity hardware, using really small or large amounts of cheap compute power that you can scale up and down on an as-needed basis. So as Microsoft, we are working together with a company called Hortonworks. You might have heard about them. And we're delivering our Hadoop solutions together with them. All the work that we do actually is being made part and contributed back into the open source community through Hortonworks. So the role that Hortonworks plays is actually they create the distribution. And then what we do is we take that distribution and host that inside Azure. Now, today I'm going to focus on Hadoop 2.0, which is the latest release, because there are some significant changes, and we're going to talk about why these changes are significant and how they manifest themselves. The two big things that have changed is the introduction of a new resource manager called Yarn, which changes the way of how you interact with the system. And then there are some changes in HDFS, the distributed file system. All right. All right, now I have to rewind, start again. Okay, so the Hadoop ecosystem is building on top of two very important components. First of all, HDFS, because you have massive amounts of data, which you cannot fit on a single node. So you need to spread it out. You want to have reliability of that data, and you want to be able to access that from the compute layer above. Now, if you have a distributed file system, you cannot simply work on a file because the files are literally scattered throughout the nodes in the HDFS infrastructure, which is why you need to have a compute solution. And in Hadoop 1, that was called MapReduce. And we'll see how actually Yarn is replacing that and the kind of ecosystems that that enables on top of it. And don't worry if you don't get all the fancy acronyms. It's like that's the sport in Hadoop land. It's like come up with the most funniest name for everything. We'll come and find a whole bunch of interesting names while we're getting through the rest of the presentation. So as Microsoft, we're delivering two flavors. There is the Hortonworks data platform for Windows. And this is a self-deployable Hadoop installation that you can install on your Windows environment yourself. Now, this assumes that you are going to buy those 500 compute nodes. And we're all having those in our back pockets, right? So that's one thing. Now, what is interesting is, as a developer, you can also install a single node. And that allows you to get exposed to the programming model, to see how the infrastructure works, and spin up a virtual machine. And if you have enough virtual machine capacity, you could even install multiple nodes and create a little cluster out of virtual machines. And that gets you going and allows you to practice and build up your environment. Now, in reality, if you really want to do something more quickly, a lot of organizations are interested in hosting that in somebody else's fabric. So in Azure, we're hosting something called HD Insight. And instantly, you probably notice, like, well, HD Insight 3.0, how does that relate to Hadoop 2.0? And this is the funny thing in the Hadoop ecosystem. There are effectively three versions. There is the set of components that make up the Hadoop distribution. So HDFS is, in, I think, at 2.6. And then there's other versions for all the other components, and we can look at that. Then it's like those are bundled together into a distribution. And so right now, it's like the latest Hortonworks distribution for Windows is 2.2. And then we take that and host that inside a cluster inside Azure, and we label that 3.0, just to confuse you. Fine. So what's in there is effectively the same Hadoop data platform installation that you would be able to install on your machine yourself. The other thing is there is compatibility within the Hadoop ecosystem with regards to the applications that you run. Most of the Hadoop ecosystem is actually written in Java, and so is ours. And so if you take a MapReduce job that you wrote for Cloudera, you can pick it up, push it into Azure, and run it over there. There's no difference. The only thing that might be different is the addressing of where you store your data, of course, right? Which are facilities that you need to deal with inside your scripts. Now, while we've been working on it, we've also started contributing. And one of the areas that we contributed as Microsoft through Hortonworks is through the Stinger project. And right now, it's like we'll get back to what Hive exactly is and how it works. But one of the things that we do is like you have these massive amounts of data that you need to answer questions over. And when we started with Hadoop, everything was a file, flat files. And we were brute force computing over a set of distributed flat files effectively, creating MapReduce results and giving you an answer at the end. So it was a divide and conquer through brute force and by throwing a lot of capacity at the problem. The problem with flat files is that, A, it's like they take up much more space than compressed files. Therefore, it's like their memory footprint is huge. So if you want to do something like a query compilation over it, it's like your memory usage, and therefore your CPU usage is a lot higher. So we introduced the ORC file type into the community. And we first introduced that in Hive 11, which was part of the Hadoop distribution 3.1.3. And we were able to get it down significantly and speed up the queries. In the latest release, we were even able to speed it up further. And the next wave of improvements we'll talk about actually at the end when we talk about the capabilities that are being enabled by the new infrastructure that is in Hadoop 2.0. But it gives you an idea of how the evolution goes inside the Hadoop ecosystem. And by this contribution, that is actually it's like the whole environment benefits from it. So let's get started first by creating our Tech Days cluster. So the first thing that I'll do, yes, I'm on the right monitor, sorry. So I'll go to my Azure subscription. How many of you have an Azure or MSDN subscription? How many of you then use Azure? You know that's part of your subscription, right? I have the same thing. We don't get a free one. It's like we get an MSDN subscription. So it's like you can see it's like I just started at $150 yesterday. I was running some compute jobs last night to practice. And so right now I'm down to $133. But OK, that's fine. So regardless, it's like what's Azure allows you to do is provision your cluster in a very seamless way. So we'll go to new, and we want a data service, HD Insight, and we can do a quick create. And what this allows us to do is, with the minimum amount of effort, create a cluster. Let's call it Tech Days. Not sure if that's not allowed. Tech Days 2014, no, well. This one, of course, doesn't matter. OK. So now it's like I need a cluster size, which my browser doesn't want to show right now. OK. And then you need a password. At that point, you get a vanilla cluster set up. The choices are four nodes, 32 nodes. That's just default. That's not the minimum or the maximum of the environment. The other thing that you need to realize is that if you want the latest version, the 3.0, you need to go through the custom creation process where you can pick 3.0 as the environment. So here you pick, say, Tech Days NL. That's not there. Good. And we want 100. And we want to provision them. Well, do we believe we're part of Western Europe or Northern Europe? All right, let's make it close by. And I think I'm running out of my, I'm not allowed to actually create that with my subscription. So it's like we'll do, I'm out of my bandwidth because I already have a cluster up and running. So much for that. So I created my cluster with a less interesting name. It's called GERDDHD. For the same reason I was looking for names earlier, it's like because it had to fit in. And that gives me my dashboard. It's hooked up to my storage one. So it is hooked up to a storage account, which we'll see is the common place where all the information is being stored. So if I upload MapReduce job to the cloud, it will go into this storage account. All right, so if we would use Storage Explorer, and so this is Storage Explorer. I have my job, my environment here. It's like I have a container called GERDD or GERDD container. This is the default container that Hadoop will write through. And then here you see all the files that is being actually produced by running jobs, their MapReduce outputs. If I would scroll all the way to the bottom and then zoom back in. Like here, you will see this file over here, the word count. Like word count is the hello world of Hadoop. Right, what do you do with MapReduce? Well, you can print out hello world on four nodes, it doesn't make a lot of sense because you don't see anything. So the canonical example in a Hadoop world is to take some text and count some words. Right, you split up the inputs, and then it's like you compute something. And then it's like the output is being pushed back. So we'll do that in a moment. So as you see, it's like the storage account actually plays an integral role inside your Hadoop environment. And this is where it's like you also is like if you need to push data in, this is one of the avenues of getting data into the system. You can also interact with your SQL Server databases or your MongoDBs or other installations that you have. All right. Of course, now I'm lost where I was. Okay, here we go. So let's talk a bit about HDFS. All right, so as I started off, it's like we have large amounts of data. And so the two key things that came out of, like, where did Hadoop actually come from? All right, it came out of the work that Google did with regards to GFS, the Google File System, and MapReduce. Right? Those were two papers that they wrote of how they actually solved the internet search problem. And those two thoughts and starting points were taken by Yahoo, who created Hadoop out of this. Right? And therefore, it's like it's not surprisingly that the underpinnings of Hadoop starts with a file system. And as I said earlier, the key thing here is that you have lots of nodes that you spread the files over. So by default, the file size is the chunk size, or the block size, I should say, sorry, is 64 megabytes. So if you have a large file, Hadoop will chop it up and start distributing blocks across nodes. The other thing that it will do is it will automatically replicate those blocks at least two times. One to a machine inside the same rack, and one to a machine outside of the rack, right, to create a high availability situation. Then if you access the information, you have to ask somebody, because now it's like we took your file and shredded it. So now how do you access this? Well, you have to ask somebody that knows, and so there is a name node, that actually knows about where the information lives and how to access it. So if you're writing a job, you need to point it to some opaque moniker that is resolved by the name node and then handed out to the actual data nodes. So that's the role of HDFS. If you look at it, it looks like a file system. It's a completely hierarchical structure of directories and files. Right? So it's like it manifests itself, it presents itself as an hierarchical file system. The only thing is like it's distributed. Because it's distributed and block-based, it's highly optimized for write once and read many. Right? If you want to write a random I/O application like a relational database like SQL Server, you would fail. Right? I spent 9 years of my career working on SQL Server, and that would not be a good idea. SQL Server is not optimized for that. Now, it's like a lot of the Hadoop applications are optimized around the idea that they can work with these sequential streams, which are most of the times manifesting themselves as a very small number of very large files. And then you operate over those streams. So now we have our data. We have distributed it. We have made it highly available. Now we need to do something with it. So we'll introduce you to the data center in a far, far away place, not that long ago, right? Which was MapReduce. That was the first incarnation of how we were going to operate over this. So what is MapReduce doing? Well, it allows us to operate over the data through two very small principles, a map function and a reduce function. And the map function, applied over an input set, returns a list of key value pairs. Now it's like we can reshuffle that data and hand them to the next step, which is the reducer, which takes a key and a set of values. and now produces the output that you want. Because these two functions are completely decoupled, it's embarrassing parallel. I can take that and push that to a lot of nodes. And mainly what I'm doing is I'm partitioning over the inputs. Wait a minute. Let's wind back and think about HDFS. What is HDFS? It partitions your data in 64 megabyte chunks. Ah, that's interesting. So my data is already parallelized over a set of data nodes. Now, if I associate that with a set of job nodes, I have data locality and I have parallelism. Right? Those are the underpinnings of the MapReduce framework. So in code, that looks something like this. Again, here is the Hello World example of word count. We have a map function that splits the value in words, and then we're going to count those words, and we're going to write that out. That will produce us a list per word with the value. All right. Then we feed that into the reducer, and the reducer will go over this and then produces with the answer. So let's practice that. So we have this England sentence that you might have seen at school as well. The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. And we're going to use 100 nodes to figure out the word count, just because we can. So we write a mapper. And so we feed in every word into the sentence. And by default, everything in the first one is always of value 1. Because right now, we only need to produce values for each word. So we just need to identify a word, give it a count. So the 1 is actually hard-coded in this case. Then we need to shuffle this. So we put all the buckets together. And once we shuffle this, we now see that it's like we have the twice, because that's the only word that is repeated. And then everything goes from there. And then it's like we actually go feed it into the reducer, and that says that the is 2, quick 1, and so on. So we did our first MapReduce example. Very simple, very basic, but it actually tests the principles of how you can do this. Again, the advantage of this principle and this setup is that it's highly parallelizable, which jives very well with the notion of I want to take a cluster of commodity hardware made out of cheap boxes that I know that will fail, but I don't care because I have redundancy built in and I have restartability built in, as we see in a moment, which allows us to do those kind of jobs at a much lower cost than we would be able to do before, because now we make it a commodity problem. Now, to do this, it's like you have to write a bunch of code. And so here is the Java code that was used for this particular example. This is the original word count example that was actually came out of the first release of Hadoop. Now, the things is like, yes, you write two classes, you write a mapper, and you write a reducer. But there are some interesting parts about this. Let's see if I can operate this thing. So first of all, you see here the mapper introduces a new type of long writable, int writable. So here, it's like I said, every time we have a word, it needs to become 1. So in order to drive the serializer, we need to use these types that actually serialize themselves as a certain type. You cannot use a standard int. So as a result, there's a lot of ceremony in this code to actually make it work. All right. On itself, not too bad, but still, it's ceremony, and you need to deal with it, and it's different than from what you write normally. So what happens in computer science when there is a lot of ceremony? We build a level of indirection called an abstraction. All right. So what you see that happened is, although it's like Hadoop started as two very rudimentary pieces, HDFS, and MapReduce. Now an ecosystem was starting to grow on top of it that was based on providing abstractions over MapReduce to make people do their work more efficiently and so that it would scale more. So the first one that was introduced was PIG. And if you go to their website, they will tell you that pigs eat everything. They're very domesticated animals, and so therefore they should be allowed to serve your data. All right. And there are more jokes like that, but they're on their website. So PIG is a data flow language, and it's really sort of awkward language. It starts off with defining is like the structure that you input. So here is like you're designing the input map. So he says, I'm going to read from this file, which is above here, right? This weblog files in this case. Nicely borrowed from my colleague. And we're going to say is like this file is made of the following fields. And we assign types to them. So now we have a type structure that we can work over. And then we're going to define some steps that we're going to do, and it's like it's a data flow language. So the next thing is the operations that we can apply. We can write our own UDFs, so our own functions that we're going to apply to this. And then we're going to tell you is like where we're going to push this and what the output is and what we're going to do with this. Now, I don't know about you, but this is not a very accessible language. Now, I'm a SQL Server guy. But I don't know many data analysts either that would be able to comprehend this. So for those of us who knew SQL as a query language, another abstraction was created called Hive. And Hive is really a query language, and it looks like SQL, it smells like SQL, but it has more external DDL capabilities than you might expect in a regular SQL, like an Oracle or MySQL or SQL Server. So first of all, it tells you that this is an external table. What does that mean? Well, this is a definition over something that I don't own. This is like a linked server definition inside SQL Server. I don't own the data, but I do know how it looks. All right, so again, it's a mapping, a type map that we create over the same log file that you saw before. And then we say it's like we have some properties of how we want to process over this. So we want to skip the header because like we know it has a header file because it's a CSV file. Right? So we skip the first one. And then we map over it with recursion on. If there are subdirectories found, it's like we will traverse the subdirectories to find new files. And after we've done that, we can do regular stuff like we used to do in SQL. We can now say it's like select star and go from there. All right. So then it's like there are some new things that are starting to evolve. So cascading, for example, actually pushes this even further and starts to move this into the Java language. So this is a complete JVM solution and was trying to create the modern version. And if you think, it's like, wow, how many of you write link code? This smells like link. Yes, it does. Right, it's like they really looked at link, and they came up with this structure for expressing the same problem. So this is exactly the same code, or will result in the same result, I should say, than the previous incarnations that you saw in Java before, and then it's like you could do the same thing in Hive and PIG, but we did log processing there. The other thing is it allows you to create UDFs. So here we introduced our nice scrub function that is like allows us to clean the data, and we actually interjected that here inside our syntax. So this is how you see is actually that ETL is a very natural ingredient inside the Hadoop world. Because you're dealing with a lot of data sets that you're bringing in as streams of data. You write your type map, and then you go through this. And if you have anomalies, you can deal with those in line when you hit it by running them through a UDF or to some other functions that you might have available for you. So this is also how it's like the ETL workflow process. A lot of people these days are trying to utilize these kind of environments as a distributed ETL process. Internally, inside my team, we actually built disposable catalog systems. So I'm responsible for the data fabric inside Xbox Live, Windows Marketplace, and Windows Phone Marketplace. So we have catalogs, right, that serve up the data about the products you can buy and all the languages it's in. And so how do we create those catalogs is from streams of data inside an Hadoop-like installation. We run MapReduce jobs over those data to actually generate disposable SQL servers. Then we then push to the edge so that they're close to the web servers that actually use this. And that's how we deal with the problem. So it's an interesting use case maybe to think about. All right, so this is word count and scaling. Now, the thing about those abstractions are they are abstractions. There are levels of indirection that still lead to MapReduce. So this same word count thing will fall down into a mapper stage, which will start to do things. So it's like what scalding does is it takes this syntax and translates it into a set of steps, operations, you can say, MapReduce operations, that it will use to execute and come to the results. So effectively, it creates a query plan. Right, and so the top one, the blue one, is the mapper. Right, it feeds it into an HFS file system, delimits it. It does a for each, does a regular expression split, and then it goes through this. It does a group by, and then for every, and then it writes it out to a file. Effectively, this is a query plan as a set of MapReduce operations. So now, why is that bad? Well, in order to answer that question, we need to go back to the MapReduce architecture inside Hadoop itself. All right. So when Hadoop 1 was created, it's like this was the architecture for MapReduce. A client walks up to an entity called the job tracker and says, like, here I have a job. Please execute it for me. And what the job tracker then did is like it looked at it and says, like, oh, it was like you need a bunch of resources, so I'll create some tasks, which became task trackers, and those were going to execute the tasks over a set of nodes that he had to its availability. The thing was, it's like everybody starts to report back status, and the job tracker was doing a lot of things. It was in charge of the resource management. It was in charge of status tracking, restartability, recovery, distribution of resources, all these things. So what do you think happened when you grew over 400 nodes inside your Hadoop cluster? We were starting to run into bottlenecks, whereas like the job tracker was no longer able to keep up. So now you have to start splitting your cluster, which is exactly not what you want. Because now it's like you're starting to work against your economy of scale. Right, you want to keep striping as horizontally as possible to a degree where it's like you actually don't care. So this was one of the issues that we needed to start solving in the new Hadoop installation. So out of this came Yarn. Anybody has a clue what Yarn stands for? Yet another resource negotiator. We can use one of those in the world right now. So this one is trying to actually do one important thing. The first thing that when Yarn was invented, in the first incarnations of Yarn, it was actually trying to rewrite how we dealt with MapReduce to deal with some of the consequences of the implementation. So it first started out as an optimization of the MapReduce framework. Then they came to the realization that the biggest thing that they should do is have separation of concern between the compute model and the resource model. So what Yarn does is effectively split that responsibility. So it's no longer in charge of the execution, but it's only a mechanism to actually get a lease on resources. So the new infrastructure, and if you do things like this, like you maybe know out of your own practice, it makes the picture a bit more complex. Because you're now, it's like our separating concerns. And by separating concerns, you have more people that you need to go talk to. But each of them only do one thing, and hopefully they do a better job and they do a more efficient job at that. So in the new structure, the client still submits something called an app now to the resource manager. An app is an overloaded term here, but think of it as the MapReduce job, the word count job that you need to go execute. Later on, we'll see that app has a broader term, and which is why they're actually using the term app, because this architecture is no longer restricted to just focus on MapReduce only. Okay. So the first thing that the resource manager now does, it creates the app master. And the app master in the system, that is the one who is now going to ask the RM for containers. So the roles are now inversed, whereas like the app master is the controller, and the resource manager is nothing does nothing else than handing out resources to its to the ones who want to execute inside the environment. So once it has the containers, it now is able to start executing, and we need to report status. That's also changed because the reporting of the status now goes to the application master, right? And the nodes itself, the node managers, only report status to the resource manager. So the model has been more complicated. There are more lines. More lines mean more communication, yes, true. But there's also separation of concerns, which allows us to scale out. And by removing a lot of functionality from the resource manager, you don't have this bottleneck in the architecture. So let's go into our Hadoop cluster and run some jobs. Oops, I don't need to know what time it is. All right, let's go back here. I'm in my Hadoop environment. And so one of the things I can do if I'm in configuration is like I can actually terminal server into it. So I can RDP into my cluster, which will get me to the node that hosts the Azure or the node tooling. So that's this node. As you see, it comes with a default desktop where you have a command line for all your Hadoop commands. It comes with the Hadoop node name status and the Yarn status. And the Yarn status is gives you where it's like which used to be the job tracker. So for those of you who looked at this before, this actually gives you the information about it's like what is going on. Let me see if I can. That might be a little aggressive. Let me tone that down one. Okay. Can you see this in the back? It's good enough. Okay. Thank you. So for all the applications, it allows you to see it's like what state these things are in. So you can see is like we have new ones, we have ones that are saving, it's like that are being in deployment right now. We are running, if we remove things, things that have failed, that you have killed, all those things are in there. So it's like right now if I go to finish, this I should see a significant list of things that I've been running. And they're all of the type MapReduce right now. I had one Yarn job here that we'll see at the end of the session. And so let's see if there's anything running right now. And there's nothing running. Okay. So let's kick off some work. And the way I'm going to do that is by using PowerShell. So one of the ways you can interact with this is like we brought, so our goal with Hadoop is to actually integrate it completely into the environment. This means integrating it with Active Directory from a security point of view, pushing ACLs into HDFS. It's like integrating it with System Center, but also is like having your management and provisioning capabilities available through things like PowerShell. So if I would take this one and say help HD Insight, if I can type like this. This gives you an idea about all the things. It's like I can completely configure my cluster, right? If I have a 1,000-node cluster, which I can create, and we do have customers actually with that size of cluster, you don't want to do that through the UI. That's not something you want to do. In general, it's like in a services site or a service-like organization where you deal with services, you want to script everything. Why? Because that makes it hopefully repeatable. And that's the first thing you need to achieve. So I can create and find all my things. I'm effectively, the context in which the commandlets work are within your subscription. And the subscription is imported by importing your deployment settings. So there is this add user, where am I? That's not on here. I did it yesterday. Okay. I think this is not, for some reason, it's not listed. Now I'm surprised, so I want to find it out. Add Azure account. Yes, there it is. I wasn't smoking crack. So that allows me to actually bring my Azure account. It will pop up a security dialog. It will ask me to authenticate using my MSA or my OrkID credentials, create a certificate, download the certificate on my machine here. So now I can use that for long-running operations. All right, so now I have a security context set up based on a certificate mechanism that allows me to do all these tasks through a PowerShell environment. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to spin up a Terra sort. So I'm going to sort some data using the Gray algorithm. And so I'm going to kick that off. And it will come back, and hopefully it will show some status in a minute. That it's doing something. You see here, it's like it's waiting for some status. Let's go back here and see if I have some running job. Here I have the running job. I can drill into it and start to look at this. The reason why it's like we moved to an app model is that now every type of application, in this case, this is still a MapReduce type of application, can have their own manifestation and UI inside the portal. So every type of application can come with their own UI experience and expose their own details inside the cluster. So this is working. It's done. And the reason why it's done that fast is not that it's actually smart. It sees that it was already there. The input didn't change, so I didn't have to do anything. All right, one of the things that MapReduce does, it's like it actually sees, oh, the output stream is there. Let me do a hash check and see, it's like, oh, these are actually the same, so I'm done. All right, but you saw it running for a minute, and therefore it didn't have to spin up all these efforts inside the system. Okay. So that's MapReduce. Now, the interesting thing is that with the re-architecture of the job tracker into the resource manager and the separation of the resource manager and the node manager, you can actually start to build much more interesting things than just MapReduce. So today you will find is actually there is a project, an Apache project, that in the current system, so for Hadoop 1, is spinning up Apache web servers. And you would say, it's like, why would you do that? Well, think about it for a moment. You invested in 500 nodes for your company, and you have a need for web servers. And so you want to utilize some of those nodes. There are two approaches that you could take. You could go to the cluster and say, it's like, I'm going to take away X number of machines and take them out of the cluster. That would require reconfiguring, and now you never can go back, or it's like it's a big effort. Or you can say, it's like, I'm just going to use Hadoop to spin up those things.
So clever mind thought is like, I can do that. I just write a mapper function, and then that which has no reducer, and it just never finishes. It keeps sending status as long as the website is running, which is sort of wasteful because it's like that Apache website probably already has a status mechanism, but you get the idea. And so that's what a lot of people were actually trying to do. And so that was one of the reasons when the Yarn team was working on this that they realized it's like that they needed to separate this out for other reasons as well. And that reason was to actually start allowing different kind of applications. So now what you see, I stole this picture from the Hortonworks guys. You have still this foundation. You have HDFS as a distributed file system. You have Yarn as the operating environment that sits on top of that. But now you have different kind of applications that serve different specific stovepipes of solutions that can now be efficiently hosted inside the environment. There are some other interesting projects that are coming on. So, for example, Storm is a complex event processing framework or application created by the Twitter guys. Right, how do the Twitter guys analyze their event streams? Well, they use technology like this. So they created Storm as a way to process, do complex event processing over streams. So now you can plug that in, right, and see is like here in the streams pipe, is like you actually see Storm listed there. HBase now is another form that is can run as a Yarn application. Spark and Shark are actually data processing, data analytics environments from Berkeley. Giraffe is a graph processing library. It allows you to do complex graph processing. Today, it's like graph processing is very doable if all your data fits on a single node, ideally in memory. All right. What if you have a social graph that is larger than your node? That's exactly the problem that Giraffe is addressing. Hamster, on the other hand, is allowing you to take existing MPI applications, message passing applications, and deploy them on Yarn. So that actually allows you to take existing investments in MPI infrastructures, mainly used in HPC or technical computing environments, to move those. And then we see other environments like Memcached that allows you to spin up an environment and say, like, hey, I want to use this as a cache. Here you see it as a provisioning mechanism. Dryad, how many of you have heard about Dryad? One person, thank you. Dryad is a long outstanding Microsoft research project for distributed computing. And what they did is they actually brought Dryad, and we'll look at it in a minute, and brought it to Hadoop. And so now it actually can take developers in .NET can take advantage of the Yarn infrastructure through well-known constructs that every .NET developer knows and hopefully loves. So, okay. So how do I write a Yarn application? How do I write one of those stovepipes? How do I do that? Because everybody can do this. This is not a closed ecosystem. Effectively, the only requirement that you have to interact with the resource manager is to use Protobuf. Protobuf is the protocol buffers implementation that Google wrote. That's the default protocol, actually. It's like the protocol is pluggable. But the default protocol is Protobuf. So if you want to interact from here with the resource manager, you talk through Protobuf. And so that's how you write your application. So, okay, so how are we going to do this? Well, now we need another Hello World. Because now we need a distributed Hello World that does something, and it's like we're not going to use word count because we already proved that world. So we're going to use a distributed shell. So what this does, it actually goes through every node and pops up a shell and allows you to do something. All right? And The idea there is like I need to provision something on all my nodes. Very derived sample, but it sort of demonstrates what you need to go do. So what we're going to do is we're going to walk through the code that actually is listed in the GitHub repository for this. It picked up my screen size. Okay, that's good. So this is a Java program. So you see, it like picks a lot of things in there, and we're not going to read through all of this. I was looking for the init function. All right, here's my main function. So the first thing it does is like it needs to orchestrate all the interactions with the resource manager, right? And so what it will do is like it will walk up to the resource manager and it says like, hey, I'm here. It's like I need resources. I need to go through all the nodes. I need to do something. And then the resource manager is going to call back on a set of overrides. Here, it starts to run. Next one should be the overrides. Yep, here's callback handlers. So there's a set of callback handlers that say, for example, that are being called if I'm finished, if I'm killed, all the situations, the whole state machine is exposed as a set of callbacks. And so when I looked at this, I was like, okay, that's not inspiring. I had this idea, it's like I'm going to take the weekend, I'm going to squint, I'm going to pretend that Java is C#, I'm going to rewrite the protobufing, I'm going to make this work. I completely failed. I couldn't do it in the amount of time that I had envisioned to actually go do this, even that I had the code and I had a working protobuf stack. There was too much ceremony involved, again, to actually make this happen. So, history repeats itself. What happens if you have too much ceremony? Well, by now you know the answer. You build another level of abstraction. So, tests is one of those levels of abstractions, which was created and is like, it actually is a framework that deals with direct graphs for processing data. Now, the best way to illustrate that is actually look at the result. So here is like before this, you had a set of cascading and depending MapReduce tasks. What tests allows you to do is two things. It allows us to fold things, and the reason why it allows us to fold things is by preventing from having to write the data to disk and therefore start a new mapper with a new reducer. Because every intersection here is read from disk, read, write, read, write. Right? So at some points, you have workloads that are more interactive in nature that really benefit from the fact that it's like you write as few times as possible. And this framework actually allows you to do this. And so what we'll see actually is like the Hortonwork guys already produced 3 blog posts so far about how they can leverage tests as a framework to improve the Hive query performance. Remember, Hive turns SQL into MapReduce jobs. Now what they've done is they've said, is like I have Hive turn SQL into test representations, which plug in directly into Yarn, which therefore is like prevents having us to serialize to disk the many times that we had to do before, and therefore provide a much faster execution environment. Of course, there's a trade-off. But as we'll see, one of the things in the Hadoop ecosystem is really about building specialist solutions that can solve solutions for a broader group of people. The next implementation that is actually on its way is Reef. This is a Microsoft research project as well out of the Silicon Valley branch of Microsoft Research. This actually runs as a GVM or JVM, And it's really is like trying to focus on providing a task-based programming model. And you say, it's like, hey, that sounds familiar, a task-based programming model. It's like, how does that relate to what we're doing in .NET? And we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's really focused about building distributed apps. All right. So what we see is that Yarn is much more than a MapReduce hosting platform. It actually now allows us to build distributed application and be a resource governor for distributed workloads. The last one is Kitten, just because I want to play with some Yarn. This is a Cloudera project. And what they did is they used Luau, which is a script-based definition language, to describe the payloads that you're working over, and that's being fed into the compiler and then being used to actually achieve the same thing. Their focus is on ease of deployment. And so what we see right now is like in October last year, Yarn was born, or released, I should say, sorry. It was released, it was G8 in October. And right now is like this is the state of the universe in terms of developments that allow us to build solutions in a much broader form. Now the last one that I have not talked about was Dryad. So Dryad allows us to take the things that we know and probably you are familiar with as a Microsoft crowd as a bunch of C# and link calls. So what it does is like Dryad takes link and turns it into Yarn calls right now. It used to push it into distributed compute operations inside a Dryad cluster. Now it actually transposes that and talks to the resource manager in Hadoop through the Yarn interface. So it allows you to write things like in a very natural way. So first of all here, it's like we define some input sets. So we read some config information. This is where we get the DaVinci text. And how do we do this in C#? Well, we do a split. We feed it into a select many, so we get a list of words. Then we're going to do a group by. We're doing a count. We're sorting it, and we're writing the output. And now the next thing that we need to go do is actually submit this. So this is research code, so I can't predict if the demo gods will be with me or not. I'm going to try it anyhow. All right, so here I have VS. It works with 2012 and 2013. Right now I'm running 2013. The way you actually get this, and so if you have HD Insight, you do need to use the Trio cluster or the latest on-premise Hadoop distribution. The thing, how this got introduced, not a surprise probably, is to NuGet. Well, it already is like. All right. So here it is, Yarn installed package. It brings in a whole bunch of other packages, and it has the sample application. So actually, to get you up and running, it's like you simply select the sample Dryad link program, and what it will do is like it will inside the console application. All you have to do is install that package. It will bring in all the dependencies. It needs JSON to talk, and it, like, it needs some process manager. After that, it's like you will end up with a console project with where they add the new file called word count, which has this static file, which looks like what we discussed on the slide. Let's get this out of the way. So I'm going to set up my context. I'm not going to execute this locally, although that is a very interesting flag, because how do you develop as a developer? You need to test this. And one of the advantages that this environment has, it allows you to actually set local execution to true, and it's like, we'll just execute it on your box. And at least that way you can debug your workflow. All right, which is one of the challenges, of course, in distributed computing. We load the information, the same file as on the slide. We do the select many, yada, yada, yada. And we have a stopwatch that we wrapped it into. Okay, so let's hit F5 and see if we are lucky. Well, something is happening. We have a query plan. So the first thing that it does is it actually devises a query plan from going over the code by inspecting it. And now it will start to upload resources into the Hadoop cluster. And so as you will see, it's like it will take resources and push them up into the cluster. And some of them are pieces of code that comes with the framework, and some of them are derived from your application. All right. If you are interested, it's like, so if you do this, and then it's probably not a good experience. Let's do, this, here we go. This is the query plan that came out of this. And so it creates some information. The more interesting thing is in here, where it starts to say, it's like, hey, these are the continuations that we actually need to ship to the other side. Right? Because like we don't need all the orchestration. We just need to know what the actual pieces are that we need to ship and how we can pass that on. So right now, it's like it will run. It's like normally, if the demo gods are with me, it's like it's 100 minutes or 100 seconds, sorry, for actually for DaVinci to come back. And it says, like, well, it was fast today. It must be the weather, or it's like the European data center. So we have the information now. So let's go to our provider or our browser. This is should have... Actually, I need to refresh this. I'm glad I'm not on wireless, because otherwise this would take forever right now. Okay, here we go. All right, here we have our latest version. So we can, if I can see this, I can download this. This is not going to download because I'm using, sorry, I need to do some massaging of my output. I was a little bit too I was like, the semicolons is like don't work in a file name, so we'll do it like this. Okay, so rename this guy. Yeah, you done? Yes, okay. And then we're gonna download this, put it on the desktop. Okay. Go to my desktop. This is today, right? It's the 16th, yes. Take our friend NotePass. And DaVinci used the word is 4,088 times. And so that's divided over, in this case, I only used 4 nodes because I used my MSDN subscription, in 97 seconds to go over all his inputs. So it allows you to see is like how you can actually take this, bring it into your own environment, match it up with the language that you know, if that might be C# or Java or JavaScript. That allows you to go from there. All right. So that was MapReduce in C#. You can write MapReducers in plain C# just in the same way that you do that in Java. I thought that was less interesting. We talked about this. Sorry, I flipped back. Kittens.net, which gets me to the end, right? So how does this all fit together? So what we're doing is we're actually building a whole data platform where it's like we're fitting in both existing assets as well as new assets. What Hadoop does is it enables us to go after new scenarios that we want to fit into our data platform. Stream processing over big sets of data, distributed ETL processing, data warehousing scenarios, all of this fits in with that. But it's a lot of data exists today already in SQL servers, in OLAP cubes, in other data sources. So it's a whole ecosystem that we're building. We didn't talk about things like Scoop. Scoop is a part of the ecosystem that allows you to bring information from Hadoop into a relational database and from a relational database into Hadoop. All right? And because you need to be able to bridge this, because at the end of the day, We can process as much data as we want, but you need to be able to make the last mile and get it in the hands of the users. All right, that's where the reporting services, the Excel add-ins, right? It's like you can take the Hive ODBC driver and plug it into Excel. So now it's like your Excel query actually becomes a MapReduce job. So it will run on the cluster, it will crunch some numbers and bring it back for the user and present itself inside Excel. Right, that's the ecosystem that we're building to enable end-to-end distributed computing over data, which is all umbrellaed under the name of the Microsoft Data Platform. With that, it's like there are some links inside the slide deck to get you going. As I said, it's like if you have an MSDM subscription, just check it out. Just go online. You can see the ticker on the top if you spent your money or not. I constantly watch that because I don't want to get it on my own credit card. But it allows you to start doing things and create your own ideas of how you can apply this kind of technology to solve problems that you have at hand. There is a great getting started with HD Insight. If you want to do it in a VM, this is the link to the Hortonworks distribution. It's an MSI. The only thing you need to install is Java and Python 2.7, and then you can start running. And it's that simple. So with that said, I'm at the end of what I wanted to talk about. Let me know what you thought. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, have a great day. Thank you very much.